Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council meets behind closed doors and decides to preemptively settle a lawsuit over text sent by a council member to the police chief that, as another council member, levels charges of unethical, immoral, and illegal behavior on that body. The proposed city budget is released with no property tax increase. At long last, the race for a seat on the state Supreme Court ends as the Republican challenger, Jefferson Griffin, concedes. Another change at the Board of Elections and Real ID begins. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News political reporter Steve Harrison. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor at Queen City News. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So good thing we don't have any news.
That's right. Let's get to it. On a normal week, when the Charlotte City Manager unveils his budget proposal to council, we would have led with that, but not this week. We'll get to that a little bit later on, but that announcement was overshadowed by news of a closed-door session that preceded that meeting. At that closed-door session, council voted to preemptively settle a potential lawsuit by CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. Steve, why was there a threat of a lawsuit hanging in the balance?
Yeah, Mike, this goes back to the summer of 2024 when there was a intense dispute between former city council member Tariq Bakari and the current police chief Johnny Jennings over these outer carrier vests, these protective vests. Bakari wanted officers to be able to wear them, and the chief at the time did not. And the two men got it into an intense argument. Bakari sent a series of text messages to the chief, you know, asking him to change his mind, and then increasing the rhetoric, starting to threaten him, say, "I will work to get you fired." And then in kind of the most the nastiest text message, he said he would work to cripple his legacy. Jennings was obviously upset by this, and I think it's apparent wanted to get this out in the public. We wrote a story, WFAE wrote a story about the messages in November. There was an ethics complaint filed by Corinne Mack of the NAACP in January, which was dismissed, and it seemed like the whole thing had blown over. Nothing was going to happen. And then the news of this settlement is broken. WSOC did a lot of good reporting on the closed sessions inside the meeting. And we now have this huge controversy over whether the settlement was warranted, how it was conducted, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, if Jennings was upset by it, and perhaps rightfully so, by these texts from Tariq Bakari, why was he suing the city? Why didn't he just sue Tariq?
Well, I think the main question is Tariq doesn't have any money. And so the city is, you know, Tariq worked for the city as a city council member, and the city has deep pockets and has the ability to, and is, you know, is the employer of both of them. We don't know exactly what claims that Jennings was threatening to make, either verbally or in writing. But I think the main, it stems back to the fact, I think part of this is that the text messages went public back in November, and there was complete silence from the city. The mayor never apologized to him. There was never any kind of rebuke of Bakari. Everyone pretended it didn't happen. And I think, you know, from what I understand, the police chief was pretty upset by that. I mean, he's seething over this lack of response to these messages attacking him. Now, again, the question is, whether that warrants money or not, he's the police chief of one of the nation's biggest cities. You're going to take a lot of slings and arrows. And again, that leads back to the controversy over, is a payout warranted?
Eric.
To Steve's point, I thought it was really interesting this week at the press conference on Wednesday afternoon at the government center. You know, as Steve said, for months there was no response, and then all of a sudden, on one hand, they were condemning their fellow council member Victoria Watlington for what she had said, but they were also closing ranks behind the chief and saying that he is the best chief in the nation. And I think the mayor made a comment to the effect of, I should have said this earlier, or, you know, he is, I stand by the chief. She kept saying that. So clearly there's been a big shift here of late.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, to Eric's point, the mayor apologized for not coming to the chief's defense sooner. And that is pretty rare for Mayor Lyle. She does not issue apologies very often slash at all. And so I think she realized perhaps that if the city had addressed this earlier, they might have been able to avoid all of the ensuing mess.
We'll hear that apology a bit later. There are a lot of layers to this, and we're peeling them back like an onion, and they seem to be peeling back in the news by the hour, it seems. Mayor Lyles was on this program earlier this week. We talked about this incident. We talked about the closed session. We talked about the amount of money, or at least I asked her about all of these things, and she refused to answer any of those questions, and here's why.
Human resource items in closed session are not appropriate for me to talk about. I think we've had this conversation once before, and it's just one of those things, and I can't remember who followed up on it, but honestly, there is no way for a council member to talk about what happens in a closed session meeting.
And later in the day, at a press conference addressing this matter, interim Charlotte City Attorney Anthony Fox corroborated that statement.
The law also provides that when you go into closed session, that information is confidential. It's not to be shared, and it actually imposes criminal sanctions against any individual that is found to have violated that law.
But Steve, you say that is not how this law has been interpreted in the past.
Yeah, it's a bit tricky. North Carolina law allows for public bodies like the city council to go into closed session to discuss a number of things like economic development or litigation. There's no requirement that those discussions stay private. There's just nothing in the statute that says that. Now, what the statute does says is there is personnel information for employees, like what's in their file, like an evaluation or a demotion letter, et cetera. Those can't be released under any circumstances, whether it's from a closed session or in any sense. Now, I think there's a question, does a verbal or a written threat by the chief to file a lawsuit go under his personnel file, perhaps? There were questions about the procedure of how the votes were taken. Is that part of his personnel file? I'm not sure. But the interim city attorney's statement that anything at any time from a closed session cannot be disclosed, it's just not what the law says. And the previous city attorneys in this city have never interpreted it that way.
And in fact, I think it was one of the stories you have reported on in this. The former County Commissioner Bill James used to record these private sessions and release the recordings to the public. Was that your reporting?
Yeah, Bill, former Commissioner James had this pen. It was like a secret, like spy recording pen. And he would just record them. And when he felt it was in the public's right to know, he would just put it all out there.
Go ahead.
And, you know, there was no, I'm sure his colleagues at the time were very annoyed with him because they want things to stay private. But no, there was no penalty for him.
Well, speaking of right to know, there was a payout agreed upon. I've seen figures between $100,000 and $300,000 to the police chief, and I asked the mayor what that figure was, and she would not give me the figure. Do we know what that figure was?
I was told at least $100,000 in a massive online social media post. Krista Bakari, Tarek Bakari's wife, said it was $300,000. I mean, at some point, we will be able to piece together the numbers through public records requests for checks, et cetera. But right now, we don't know an exact number.
I mean, why wouldn't this be taxpayer? We are taxpayers. This is our money. Why wouldn't we have the right to know what that figure is right now? This is an election year. Right.
Fair question.
So this comes on the heels of the city also paying the former city attorney in excess of $200,000 to make him go away And the reason for him going away is still unknown, because they never really fired him. He just disappeared and they paid off his what they owed him. Why did the city feel it necessary to preemptively settle with the police chief as opposed to allowing this to go to court and settling then?
I would assume, now this is going to be speculation on my part, that when you're the police chief, you have seen a lot, you know a lot. He's worked in the city for 30 years. He knows a lot of things. And the idea of depositions and a lawsuit was probably just something they weren't interested in doing and having dirty laundry aired potentially. Now, again, is that a good reason to spend six figures of taxpayer money? I think that's debatable. But yeah, I think there was a motivation on their part to just sweep it under the rug. And there's one more piece of this I think that's interesting. I talked to Mike earlier about that ethics complaint that Corinne Mack had filed back in January. At the time, the new interim city attorney, Anthony Fox, dismissed it. He said there was no grounds to move forward. The ethics complaint was against Bakari. At the time, the interim city attorney said, there's no reason that we're going to dismiss this. There's nothing there. And then a few months later, he oversees this settlement. And it's hard to understand how you go from dismissing the complaint that was at the heart of the case to then overseeing the payout.
There were actually two closed door sessions involving discussions about the payout to the chief of police. You report, Steve, that the first one, council member had to leave early and was counted as a yes vote in favor of paying Jennings. At the second meeting, one council member asked if they could change their vote, and they were told no. How do we know the details of this if these were closed door meetings?
WSOC, Joe Bruno has done a lot of good reporting from inside the closed session meetings and extracting that information. And then it's kind of been confirmed through other council members after the fact. You talked about Victoria Watlington's email where she was used some pretty inflammatory rhetoric talking about the city. And those are some of the things she was getting at. She felt like procedurally had a lot of problems with how this was handled. And so in that, the most recent closed session on Monday, just a few days ago, when council came in to talk about it, they were essentially told, well, it's done. This is over. The council member who left has been counted as a yes vote. This is finished. And we are just informing you of the status of this. And then there was a lot of time spent telling them not to talk about any of this to the public or the media.
Councilmember Victoria Watlington, who you've alluded to, sent out a fundraising email to her constituents calling the city's actions, quote, unethical, immoral, and frankly illegal. And she added that over the years she had witnessed, quote, brazen disregard for dissenting opinions and the rule of law, but never such an egregious example. And Mayor Lyles took umbrage to those remarks and made this statement about them at her press conference Wednesday afternoon.
To be clear, these allegations are unfounded, and if she has any proof, she needs to provide that to the city attorney's office, who is duty-bound to investigate.
Other members of council also took umbrage to this. Malcolm Graham, even Ed Driggs, a Republican. Victoria Watlington, on the next day, Thursday, did walk back a few of these comments. I have 30 seconds. What did she say?
Yeah, she kind of dialed back the rhetoric that she used and still kind of stood by her initial view that she feels like the process is broken. But the words were much softer.
And she said she wasn't speaking about corruption in a literal sense. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, is with us, along with Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast, and Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. We're talking about the brouhaha over the closed-door session at which Charlotte City Council decided to pay a settlement to the police chief for comments made in text messages by former Councilman Tariq Bukhari. Victoria Watling, one of those council members, initially said that she was alarmed by the unethical, immoral, and frankly illegal conduct that this constituted. Later the next day, she sent she kind of walked these comments back by saying that my fundamental desire is to operate with truth, transparency, respect, and authenticity, and that she wasn't speaking about corruption in a literal sense in terms of people accepting money for favors. Then what was she talking about, Steve?
I think she meant kind of a moral corruption, the idea of when you accumulate power, you lose. Her kind of telling, not mine, when you accumulate power, you lose sight of your original mission, et cetera, et cetera. I think Commissioner Wallington had a lot of good points, and she represents the view of a minority of council members who often feel kind of managed and steamrolled in the way city does business. But the words that she used kind of made her an easy target on Wednesday during that press conference. When you come out using words like corruption and illegal, et cetera, it really allowed the mayor and other council members to go on the offensive and really push back against her and kind of push her concerns away very easily.
The genesis of all this were those text messages sent from Tariq Bukhari, the former city councilman, to the police chief. And now Krista Bukhari is alleging unethical conduct by Charlotte officials in this payout to the chief. Krista Bukhari, of course, is Tariq Bukhari's wife. She says she has evidence of unethical and potentially illegal activity by the city council related to the council reportedly approving a six-figure payment to the police chief. She did a lengthy post on Facebook in which she says, under any other circumstance, one would provide the facts that she has to the city attorney for investigation, but Charlotte cannot rely on him to investigate himself, she writes, since I fear we will not be able to rely upon the standard complaints process of the city to validate these facts. I am hopeful the investigative journalists in our city can challenge or validate these facts until we arrive at a full and transparent understanding of this situation. What is she alleging here?
Yeah, you mentioned, Mike, lengthy. I think that, yeah, it was kind of a War and Peace length social media post.
It was over 2,500 words. I know that
it was a lot. I'd kind of referenced this earlier. I think one of the key points she made was, again, going back to this ethics complaint that Corinne Mack of the NAACP made that was dismissed. And Krista Bukhari says that when the council members initially went into closed session, they weren't told about this. I mean, they weren't told that, you know, the city had kind of dealt with this on one level earlier and dismissed it. And then now, you know, is recommending a financial payout. I think that is a fair question. And I think there are some council members who were concerned as to, well, why didn't we know this? I mean, this would be good information to have.
Meanwhile, go ahead.
Yeah, I just, part of it too is, you know, the chief is going to be here as Charlotte's chief of police. Bukhari's leaving. He's going to work for the Trump administration and the Federal Transit Administration. And the sense is, you know, I believe they want all this to be closed, case closed, and moving on as Bukhari is leaving, because they don't want to keep going on and on where he's really not even a part of city government anymore. And if you look, I mean, I think he'll fit really quite well into the Trump administration, because the language in his text were pretty vitriolic about crippling people's legacy. He's very Trumpian with that veneer of religiosity when he says this is all in God's hands now. So, you know, they want this problem to be done with.
If council wants to shut this down, and they did this by settling this, Krista Bukhari just opened it back up, and she wants to be her husband's replacement, at least temporarily, on council. Does this pump up her political bona fides, or does it hurt her chances? Because it is this council who will decide who is going to take Tariq Bakari's place.
I will say that the odds are, former Councilmember Andy Doolin, he served for many years, last decade. He's put his name in the hat. I would say that now, Andy may have been a slight favorite before this. I think that after the War and Peace social media post, Andy Doolin will almost certainly become the new District 6 council member.
Eric?
I just think, you know, it's interesting. It reminds me a little bit of what we see at the federal level, in that there's so much fighting and dysfunction right now, and there's so many allegations, and Steve is doing an excellent job of unpacking the nuances, but people really don't hear many of those nuances. They don't follow that closely. This audience does, but I'm speaking big picture. Yeah. And so, you know, we don't know yet, but I suspect that how this is going to play out over the next few months is people are going to shrug their shoulders and say, this is why I hate politics, and kind of leave it at that.
Well, here's another wrinkle. Charlotte City Council's WCNC-TV reports that Charlotte City Council's Tywana Brown has responded to allegations of illegal and unethical behavior against the mayor and city council. She issued a statement in response to the news conference that happened this week, saying, quote, as someone with expertise in harm reduction and trauma-informed care, I watched the press conference with deep disappointment and disbelief. The tone of the language and the public nature of the response were not reflective of the values of restoration, equity, and dignity that we as a body should embody. Was there something wrong with the tone of that press conference?
I think that what she's, I mean, my interpretation of what she's saying is she doesn't like the appearance of the mayor and five members of council plus two others who gave statements, you know, sort of taking a colleague to task in that public way. That was the way I interpreted it.
And she also references the fact that they went on a retreat, council did, to Asheville, and she asked how many of the people on this council trust each other, and she was the only person who raised her hand. So that may be an indication of things to come, things to look forward to on future news roundups. This leak of information from this private meeting also elicited a response from Malcolm Graham, who's concerned about this, and suggested possibly finding out how these leaks are taking place by going through council members' phones or emails. How was that suggestion received?
He brought it up, said he would ask. It's not something he could do it on his own. I think council would have to vote to do that and probably bring in outside counsel. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, if there's going to be an appetite to spend more taxpayers' money on this. But yeah, we're going to, Councilmember Graham wants to bring in the plumbers. You know, if you go back to the old Nixon days, we need to find the leaks and stop them and root them out of city government.
Yeah, I was just going to say, picking up on Steve's point, nice reference on the plumbers. This is a conversation that has gone on from time immemorial. And whoever happens to be frustrated by leaks, you know, often vows to put a stop to them. And I think even Councilmember Brown in her statement last night said there will likely be leaks again, sort of acknowledging the reality that leaks are all but impossible to stop in any political operation.
If there had not been leaks, we, the public who are paying these payouts, would not know anything about them. They would have been completely silent on this, as Mayor Lyles evidently was at the time this initially broke out. She didn't say anything, and that is why, as Steve said earlier, she felt the need to apologize.
The chief was publicly attacked by a former council member who stated his intent was to damage his reputation and end his career. I owe the chief an apology for not publicly supporting him then.
Is that her way of putting a period on the end of this sentence and moving on?
I don't think she's able to do that. I don't think she has the power to put a period on the end of this sentence, because to get to your earlier question, whether Krista gets appointed the seat, I don't think is her desire anymore. I think her desire is what happens in November, because we're voting for Charlotte City Council, and then she'll be able to actually run for election in District 6, as opposed to have to worry about this majority in council appointing her. So that's what she'll be bringing up throughout this coming election season.
So there's more council news because they unveiled the budget this week. We'll get to that in the moment. But first, the end of an era, the Riggs-Griffin era.
It's almost unbelievable that it went this far.
That's Bob Phillips with Common Cause North Carolina talking about the only unsettled contest in the nation from last November's election. He and others viewed the machinations attempting to change the outcome of that election as the possible start of future efforts to invalidate election results that people don't like. We'll have to wait and see about that because this week those efforts ended. Incumbent State Supreme Court Justice Democrat Allison Riggs, after two recounts, who won that election by 734 votes, was confirmed to be the winner. Her opponent, State Appeals Court Judge Jefferson Griffin, has refused to concede for 6 months. One of as many as 65,000 votes tossed out. This week he did, in fact, concede, Steve. Why?
He conceded because the federal courts finally weighed in. And throughout most of the 6 months, the Fourth Circuit and District Court Judge Richard Myers had deferred to the state courts to try and let them work this out. The idea was, we are not going to intervene. We are going to give the state of North Carolina every opportunity to get this right. I think Judge Myers felt that they did not get it right. They got it very, very wrong and finally had to intervene after the state Supreme Court had opened the door for Griffin to win, and he shut down the whole thing.
Eric.
Two things. One is Judge Richard Myers is a Trump appointee, and I think it is important to read at least a little bit from this decision, Mike, when he wrote, "This case concerns whether the federal constitution permits a state to alter the rules of an election after the fact and apply those changes retroactively to only a select group of voters, and in so doing, treat those voters differently than other similarly situated individuals." So to Steve's point, that really sums up the sharp difference in opinion and the opinion that mattered most.
Yeah, he wrote, "You establish the rules before the game. You don't change them after the game is done, and that requiring voter ID from overseas and military voters violates their equal protection rights." Had Griffin been successful in this, this would have called into question the integrity of this and perhaps all future elections, because politicians would continue to change the rules after the fact if they didn't win. But this decision must also have some political ramifications. Does this short circuit any future attempts to require voter ID from overseas and military voters, or could they make that change now before the next election?
Yeah, I think certainly the state board can, which now has a Republican majority. The General Assembly could. But, you know, it's interesting. If you took all overseas and military ballots in North Carolina, you know, a lot of these are military people. I'm not sure that making it harder for all of them to vote is in the Republican Party's best interest, considering many are military. It was in their best interest to require voters from Guilford and other Democratic-leaning counties to do so. But I'm not sure we'll see if the state board follows through and makes photo ID a requirement for them.
A lot of pundits
I do think it really hurts their brand too, and that's why they wanted to shut this down. And it was a Trump-appointed judge, as it has been pointed out. But the longer this went on, there was more and more reporting nationally about it. And people were questioning, you know, why is it only these counties? And it looked unfair just to the naked eye. So I think it was to their interest to concede. But I don't think it shuts down the fact that this was a playbook, a blueprint of what might happen in the future. And the Democrats said this has done immeasurable damage to our democracy, even though it ended with Riggs retaining her seat and winning that seat. And you'll see more and more of this. There were plans in place to do these kinds of things in November if Trump had come out on the losing end, which, you know, he won. But you'll see this in the future.
So back to City Council and the budget unveiled this week by City Manager Marcus Jones. The big news is that despite relatively level sales tax revenue and the need for infrastructure improvements, there will be no property tax increase this year. Good to know, but was that a surprise, Ryan?
No, I don't think so. I think that they came in here with that goal. Marcus Jones even spoke about the fact that the city was making less sales tax money than they expected, and they still didn't have to raise the property tax. So I think sort of going into this, that was probably the end goal that they worked towards instead of just a happy surprise at the ending.
So what other items in this budget, this proposed budget, stand out? What are we in for here?
Well, I think as someone who covers city council every Monday, the idea that they are removing animal care and control out from under the operations of CMPD is interesting to me, just because that has been one of the most community organized things I've ever seen in terms of there are animal shelter volunteers there begging for that to have happened almost every single month at every public forum for the last 2 years. They're going to raise the pay for all city hourly workers, I believe, to $24 per hour, receive a 4% raise. That brings even the least paid city workers to almost $50,000 annual salary. They're bringing up first responder pay. It's just sort of, they try to bring up these sort of pay rates as much as they can on any given budget. They're bringing together a few different offices to create something that they are calling the Office of Youth Opportunities, so that they can sort of get on the same page with all their different youth diversion programs that are run by different agencies and organizations that I think sort of has some promise to it, although it's not really creating any new programming in and of itself. And there are some things that they still haven't really addressed yet from the People's Budget Coalition, which is a large coalition of organizations, grassroots organizations around Charlotte. One of their top goals was to sort of get some funding for a pilot program that would mandate that apartment complexes put AC in their complexes. Apparently there's about 7,500 units in Charlotte that do not have AC as we're heading into another one of these. The summers are getting hotter every year, it seems. That was not addressed. And then a fund for victims of mass displacement, like we saw at Lamplighter Inn and Tanglewood Apartments, that was also not addressed in terms of any sort of new creation of that.
They are planning to raise fees on water, sewer, and waste collection. I think they do this just about every budget year. Cycle, don't they,
yeah.
Eric?
Yeah, they do. They do, and I think collectively, you add those three up, it's an extra $90 a year estimated for the average user. And I know Steve and I have talked about this for many years in budget cycles. One of the things they like to do is talk about not raising property taxes, but as you say, Mike, those fees go up almost every year.
So there's more to talk about that came out of that budget meeting. We'll talk about that when we come back, and a change up at the North Carolina Board of Elections and what that may mean for the future. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Mary C. Curtis is host of the Equal Time podcast and the columnist for RollCall.com. Ryan Pitkin, co-founder, editor of Queen City Nerve, and Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. We're talking about the unveiling of the proposed city budget. There's a lot of economic uncertainty out there right now, and Marcus Jones, the city manager, mentioned flat sales tax revenues, which may be flat in part because of inflation. People aren't buying as much because they can't afford to. And with tariffs looming large, those sales taxes may drop even more. Yeah, you'll pay more money and therefore more tax, but you may not buy something because you just can't afford it. So when he was on this program this week, I asked Jones about the prospect of a property tax increase next year.
We've always said we need another revenue source. We believe the one since sales tax would be helpful, even though it's just for transportation or mobility. It takes some pressure off of the general fund. So if that comes in, then the likelihood of a property tax increase goes down. If that doesn't come in, we need more revenue to continue the services that we deliver today.
And that is another aspect of the 1 cent sales tax for transit that we're asking the legislature to allow us to ask for in a referendum. Has that aspect of that tax been discussed to any degree, that this will fund things really not part of what we think of as the transit plan, Steve?
Yeah, that was really new. I heard that. I was very surprised. You know, the idea, well, it would, the tax would all fund transportation things, but then you would kind of pull some of the existing transportation money we spend today and put it toward other things. I was surprised to hear that. I think that there is a sense in the community and in Raleigh that all of the new road money that would come from the tax would be truly new road money, not replacing road money taken from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I thought that was we don't know the numbers they're talking about, how much, but I thought that was a very interesting admission on the manager's part.
So when he was here on the program on Wednesday with Mayor Lyles, that led us to a discussion of the tax for transit, which is still working its way through the General Assembly. The mayor suggested we shouldn't regard any potential increase in sales taxes as such, but rather as growth stimulating opportunities for the region.
I think that the adage is that if you're not growing, you're what? Dying? Or you're not going to be the place that we want to be. And we want to have a great city. We want to have a city that people choose, not people that they just go to Myrtle Beach after they get through.
So in essence, she wants people to understand that this is about our future and about providing money for other improvements, particularly when it comes to infrastructure. There may or may not be a vote on this in November because of where it stands in the legislature. But either way, do people, most people out there, think of our transit plan that way?
As an economic development?
Yeah.
Tool?
And an infrastructure building tool.
I think it's really hard to generalize what people think about this because, Mike, I go back to, I don't think a lot of people even know what's in this. I think it's gone through so many iterations and there's just a lot of babble and noise. So I think one of the biggest challenges, every time we've talked about this, I mentioned this, is putting together a really comprehensive campaign to explain to people what it is they're trying to do. But I want to go back to that first part of the comment, Mike. Look, we all know sales taxes are inherently regressive. There's no other way to describe it. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have them or that you can't propose them for other things, but it's a big stretch to say that, in fact, it's a way of growth and not a burden on the residents.
We've been talking about this now for years because the process has been painfully slow and the prospects of passage in Raleigh appear dim at worst, difficult at best. Mecklenburg Senator Vicki Sawyer said a couple of months ago that it's going to be difficult to ask conservative legislators for the right to raise taxes for a county they don't represent. And I pointed that out to the mayor, to that the General Assembly wouldn't be making the final decision on this. They were simply going to give us permission to hold a referendum so that the voters who live here could make that final decision. And she was very careful in her response to that.
Yes, the voters will, because the county commission will have to put this on the ballot for the fall election. So the citizens and the voters will have an opportunity to make that decision.
If they're given that opportunity by people who don't represent Mecklenburg County, that's my point.
Yeah, I got your point.
might be an admission that she's dancing carefully, as are many others around this issue. Before we move on from the mayor to other topics, this is an election year. She's coming to the end. Mayor Lyles is coming to the end of her fourth term. So I asked her, is she running again? And again, she was a bit cagey.
You know, as long as this community believes that I have something to contribute, then I will always try to do my very best to serve.
So, is she in the process of running, or is she waiting to test the tea leaves? Is she waiting for the right time to make that announcement? What's going on here?
Well, I think the mayor's history, she always declares very, very late, up to the wire. From everyone I'm talking to, it's widely expected that she's going to run again and that she will follow a similar pattern. We'll see. It could be wrong, but yeah. I think that she wants to follow through and get this transit plan approved, and she wants that to be kind of, you know, her last big act on the political stage.
So control over choosing members of the State Board of Elections was recently taken away from the governor by the General Assembly and given to state auditor, Republican Dave Bullock. He then quickly appointed new members to that board and switched the majority from Democrat to Republican. And then this week, that board fired Executive Director Karen Brinson Bell. Was this strictly, Steve, a political move, or was there a reason for this change?
I think this is strictly political. The party in charge of the board is going to want to handpick their executive director. And this is what happened going back, I think, 6 years ago when the Democrats regained control of the elections board. They fired Kim Strack, a holdover from the Republican administration, who had done a pretty good job. I mean, remember, Strack had led the investigation into the 9th District ballot scandal, which gave Democrats another opportunity to win that congressional seat, but it didn't matter. They wanted their own person in. They brought in Karen Brinson Bell, and so then this happened again this week.
But it led Siobhan Millen, who's a member now of the Elections Board, to an opportunity to express her displeasure at this decision.
I think this is a shabby way to treat a nationally admired executive election director. And further, that the recent habit of changing the executive director whenever the composition of the election board changes runs counter to our goal to bolster people's faith in fair elections.
But clearly, Steve, as you just said, that's what they do, and they've been doing it for a while now. But during her time in that position, Bell oversaw elections during COVID. She implemented photo ID requirements. She managed election disruptions during Hurricane Helene, and she did, in fact, get nationally recognized. She's being replaced by Sam Hayes, general counsel to House Speaker Destin Hall. What will that mean for the way the board conducts business going forward?
You know, we will have to see. Clearly, if you go back to the Riggs-Griffin challenge, a Republican-controlled board would have issued more favorable rulings in that situation, would have allowed investigations into these ballot challenges to move forward, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of specific policy changes, it's unclear what is coming. And going back to the early comment, I mean, it is by the Democratic board member, it is a bit shabby. It happens shabby and over a long period of time.
Mary was trying to get in there. Go ahead.
We'll have to remember that this happened because the supermajority of Republicans in the state legislature took away the power of appointment to the board from the Democratic Governor Josh Dine to the state auditor, Dave Bullock. And that was kind of unprecedented. And you can believe that if a Republican had won the governorship, they probably wouldn't have done this move. Also, this isn't over. A three-judge panel on the North Carolina Court of Appeals said that they could go ahead and appoint them, but there's still ongoing appeals. And there is some friction. Karen Brinson Bell had a statement. They adjourned before she could read it. So she had to read it, you know, her closing statement as she's outgoing with no Republicans in the room. So there's, of course, that ongoing friction. And it may change policy because we've seen in the past objections to how absentee ballots are counted or same day voter registration with voting or Sunday voting, which traditionally Democrats have favored because of Souls to the Polls and other efforts. And so, you know, they have said their priority will be election integrity. And we've seen in the past how that's kind of a code word for we're going to fight voter fraud, which doesn't exist. So you might see some changes that will affect future elections for sure.
Eric, this different. Just one quick side note on this newly comprised elections board is that former state senator Bob Rucho, a Republican, is newly elected. He was a state senator for a long time from Matthews, was a powerful senator. It will be interesting to see what he does. And the North Carolina Democratic Party instantly issued a statement condemning him for his role in partisan gerrymandering as a senator. So anyway, just wanted to add that local note.
So after years of delays, Real ID finally went into effect this week. You have to have a Real ID to board an airplane or a bunch of other documentation to get on board. And local TSA officials said they were prepared for that first day at the sixth busiest airport in the nation. And they were so prepared, in fact, that they didn't up the number of staff members on hand to handle the people who didn't bring their real IDs. Was that a good calculated risk, Eric?
Apparently it was. In advance, I didn't know that it was, but not only in Charlotte, but across the country, we really did not have many problems. I was very surprised by that. But as you say, Mike, after a brief 20-year window, this law that went into effect in 2005 now must be obeyed. So it is up and running, and the airports, including Charlotte Douglas, have done very well handling it so far.
So it's the blueprint of how to get the transportation plan to the General Assembly 20 years. TSA officials are being lenient about all this at the moment. There are other documents that you can use other than a real ID, including your passport, if you have one. But North Carolina TSA spokesperson Dan Velez was even more specific when he spoke to WBTV.
There's no need to bring a birth certificate, a W-2. We don't want people to bring those and then lose those documents. If you have your, what we're calling now, an old driver's license, and it's not a real ID driver's license, just bring that and you'll be good to go at this time.
At this time, how long might that grace period last?
Yeah, we don't know the answer to that, Mike. That's always a good question.
So Donald Trump experienced a rare defeat this week with the Republican-controlled Congress. His nominee for U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Ed Martin, faced strong opposition, and Trump withdrew his name. And among those, I guess the person totally responsible for this in a way, is Republican North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis.
If Mr. Martin were being put forth as a U.S. attorney for any district except the district where January 6th happened, the protest happened, I'd probably support him, but not in this district.
And Mary, why not?
Well, because Ed Martin has left a trail of transgressions through the rule of law, including being a lawyer for defendants at the January 6th riot. And, you know, he came from Missouri, where he had to pay tens of thousands of dollars in fines to people he had said terrible things about. He had a lot of contempt citations from courts. He had been called Biden Hitler on a podcast run by a white nationalist. I mean, this was a guy who just, his record was that bad. And you hear Tillis still hedged by saying, well, any other court, but this guy seemingly was unqualified for any position with upholding the rule of law. Yeah,
Tillis kind of drove the bus here because the vote ended up being 11-11 in the Senate committee, which meant without his vote, it couldn't get out of committee. Therefore, it couldn't be voted on by the Senate at large. So Trump had to withdraw his nomination. There's a litmus test in the Republican Party. You support Donald Trump and his policies or you're out. What does this do to Tom Tillis and his election chances, even if he did kind of whiff a little bit?
Well, Tom Tillis is running coming up in the next election cycle in North Carolina, which is shown it's a bit independent. It is pretty much reddish and it went for Trump, but it also voted for a Democrat for governor. And so you might see, even for that though, you've seen some MAGA folks saying that Tom Tillis deserves to be primary to get someone more to the right because he has not followed Trump on this issue. And I think in North Carolina, they would be afraid of that because we saw what happened when MAGA ran for governor.
And meanwhile, Senator Tillis served up an introduction in the Senate Committee on Armed Forces on Tuesday for a former North Carolina official, Tony Tata, to be Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness within the Defense Department. He failed to get a job in the first Trump administration because he was too controversial to make it to the Senate confirmation hearing. This time around, as the former North Carolina Secretary of Transportation, somebody with whom Tillis worked when he was Speaker of the House, he's got the support of Tillis, and his previous nomination was torpedoed because of comments he made about former President Barack Obama and Islam, and U.S. Senator Jack Reed from Rhode Island asked him about that at that hearing.
Prior to your last nomination, you publicly called President Obama, the commander-in-chief, quote, a terrorist leader, and said that then CIA Director John Brennan deserved to be executed. More recently, you claim that there are, quote, mutinous discussions within military ranks to sabotage President Trump.
So I have 15 seconds. Those comments disqualified him last time. What's changed and what are his chances this time?
His chances are pretty good. You see, Tellus went for him, and Trump is really consolidating control, and he has consolidated control of the Republican Party, so he's probably going to get those votes. But he's still controversial. And he was fired as superintendent of public schools from Wake County. So he is remains a controversial figure, but not controversial enough to torpedo his chances.
We into the second hour and continue, because we have 95 pages left of things to talk about. But alas, we can't. Steve Harrison, politics reporter for WFAE News. Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. We'll do the rest of the show off the air. Thank you all for the hour.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.